Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, a panel of writers and, owners of the Film Stage, who all went to Sundance and are here to talk about that illustrious festival. First, we have our benevolent Lord and Master, Jordan Raup.
Yes, I'm glad to be here.
We also have Dan Mecca.
Hello.
Hello. And John Fink.
Howdy.
How is it going, gentlemen?
Good. We've almost recovered.
Almost recovered.
I think speak for yourself.
Across all of us that went to the festival, I think we saw probably a combined 100 movies. So
good Lord.
Yeah.
And out of that, how many were good?
There was a good amount. I thought it was a really good year. It wasn't like... There's probably only one or two that would end up for top 10 contention perhaps at the end of the year. But overall, a lot of, strong films and only kind of a few duds.
All right. Excellent. Well, that's what we're going to be talking about today. All Sundance, all the time. Before we get into that, let me tell people that they should follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Find us on iTunes. Give us a comment. Give us a rating. And email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com if you have any longer thoughts that you would like to share with us. And that's about it. So guys, Sundance Film Festival, if you had to sell someone on the experience of going to Sundance, what do you think you would say to them?
Well, I'll just start quickly. For me, it's the one festival of the year that kind of, everything there feels a little fresh, like with Toronto and even Cannes to a certain extent. A lot of those movies will, at least the major ones, will be coming out and already have distribution on some of them, like within the next few months. So I think Sundance is like a great festival for discovery, and you might not always find that in like the main dramatic competition lineup, but some of the sidebar stuff and like the next section and different things, there's just a real sense that everything you're seeing, it kind of feels like, the best of what you're seeing feels like a fresh voice. And the lineup isn't as big as TIFF in the sense that you can see a good chunk of movies and feel like you kind of get a sense of the slate of the festival overall and come away, if that makes sense. Because there's only, I think, 100 or so movies versus the nearly 400 at Toronto.
Yeah, I think so. Anyone else have any selling points for the Sundance Film Festival?
Yeah, no, I agree with Jordan. It's basically just a really good opportunity to kind of see a kind of a swath of different genres. And, it's a pretty diverse slate. And I think this year, above everything else, was a good indicator of that. There's a lot of any, if you're a fan of any particular movie genre, you're going to find some representation of that at the Sundance Film Festival.
John Vink.
Yeah, I think the quality don't necessarily find at film festivals, usually the midnight ones, the bar is pretty low. Here at Sundance, I was there for 5 days and went to 4 midnight screenings. So part of the reason why I'm exhausted is because of that. But they were all quite interesting in their own way. It really is. It's a great film festival, and it's like a colder version of Toronto, I guess, in that it's freezing cold. But we got a lot done, and it's really you sort of, I think, can do things at Toronto and make contacts that you might not have a chance to make at TIFF. It feels a little bit more industry at times, more than Toronto, which I feel really is more of a local film festival. I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but I feel like you just kind of run into more interesting people on those rush lines than you do at Toronto. I'm not saying that the people aren't lovely in Toronto, but one of the objectives that we went up there for was for a program that a festival that I programmed for. So we were able to make some just interesting connections just walking around that we wouldn't normally make in other places.
All right. Well, that's a brief overview of the virtues of the Sundance Film Festival. But now let's talk about the movies themselves. We're going to do everyone's top three. And then we're going to get into a general discussion of some movies that made some noise there if they did not appear on anyone's top three. So, let's begin. Dan Mecca, what was your third favorite film at the Sundance Film Festival?
I guess I'll say Tim Sutton's Dark Knight was my third favorite film. It is a it's a short, powerful a little movie directed by Tim Sutton, who did this is his third feature. He did Pavilion, which premiered at South by Southwest, I believe, a few years ago, and then he did Memphis, which is a great movie about a musician that premiered at Sundance a couple years ago, and then this one, which is basically a meditation on a small group of teenagers and other people in this small town the day of a movie theater shooting, not unlike the James Holmes during a screening of The Dark Knight Rises. So it's a real, I mean, he has, you know, Tim Sutton has a very, I guess, cerebral kind of quiet way of shooting his movies. It can be a bit off-putting if you're not ready for that. There's not a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of ambiguity. There's not a lot of answers you're going to get. It's basically just kind of very observational. It worked for me. There's definitely a few moments that are on the nose, including the title, Dark Knight, which is obviously like kind of almost a smug reference to The Dark Knight Rises, which is almost one of the bigger problems I had with the movie is the title itself. But all in all, it really works. And there's plenty to talk about after you watch the movie. So,
all right. John Fink, you're number three.
I'm going to go with three films in three very different genres, and my number three is going to be The Greasy Strangler, which is, for my money, the movie that wins Midnight Madness at Sundance this year. And this is a film that is written and co-written, rather, and directed by Jim Hoskins, who directed one of the ABCs of Death shorts and Renegades, films that I actually I haven't seen. But this one was incredible, and as a midnight movie, it really played very well when I saw it. And it follows the adventures of two father and son team. They run a tour that gives disco history lessons to tourists that they kind of con. And they're both overweight men. They're naked for half the movie, and when they're not naked, they're in matching pink turtlenecks and short shorts. So that just kind of gives you an idea of what's going on there. So
I now know that I never need to watch this movie.
it's hilarious. And it really, I think if you see it at home, it may not work, but if you see it with an audience, the right kind of audience, they really had a great time. So Michael St. Michaels plays Big Ronnie, who's kind of the abusive father, and Sky Elobar plays Big Braden, who's his son. And it follows their misadventures. The father insists that his son cooks the greasiest food possible for him, and then insists that he's not the greasy strangler, which again is bizarre. If your hands are greasy, how can you strangle someone? But it really hits. In some ways, it's almost a little bit of a B movie masterpiece. It kind of hits all of these notes of absurdity, and it's got a mix of it's got acting so bad that it's great, and. And then it kind of follows this drama into as Big Braden becomes attached to this woman who Big Ronnie, the father, steals away from him. And it's pretty disturbing and bizarre, but it's kind of hilarious. I really enjoyed it tremendously. Jordan, not sure.
I was going to say, I saw this movie as well. To give you a sense of the audience reaction, a woman next to me gagged for like a minute during one sequence. I'd almost puked, and we were all looking at her. So that's my review of The Greasy Strangler. No, it is probably one of the most off-putting movies I've ever seen, but if that's up your alley, then you will love it. So
did you see it? Where did you see it?
It was it's a press screening. So
see, that's why. Yeah. You gotta go with the young kids.
Yeah, I guess
you gotta
that's
go with the young
reason.
Kids at midnight, the Egyptian, they'll have a good time. They're all drunk. It's great.
All right, so in the same vein, did anyone see Dark Knight and not think that that was a particularly good movie? Did anyone else see Dark Knight? Let's put it that way first.
No, I think Dan was the only
one. All right, great. Yeah. Jordan Raup, what was your number three film of the festival?
Yeah, so my pick for number three would be Todd Solondz's Wiener Dog, which is, it was initially billed as kind of a spiritual sequel or something to Welcome to the Dollhouse, his Sundance breakout. But this movie is actually it's four stories, very loosely connected by its titular star, Wiener Dog, which is literally a wiener dog, not the character from Welcome to the Dollhouse, who does appear as Greta Gerwig this time, Don Wiener. But it starts as kind of this family drama, and then it morphs into something much more twisted, as you could expect from Todd Solondz, but still has a human element. With his best movies, he kind of gets to like human truths to in a very, his own kind of perceptive, twisted way. And it's kind of his movie on the circle of life. He compared it to Bresson's classic Hazar Balthazar meets Benji. And it is really like that. And from the first section with Julia Delpy telling her child, trying to convince her child that their dog should be put to sleep so he doesn't rape other dogs or doesn't get raped. And it just it kind of sets it off the bat for what you might expect. And then Greta Gerwig and Karen Culkin team up on like a road trip of sorts. And then there's a section with Danny DeVito, which is really, I think it's probably the most personal for Todd Solondz, where Danny DeVito plays a professor in a New York college where he's been trying for 19 years to get a script made and talking to studios that just shut him down. And so it's just kind of, and then the last section I will say also is probably my favorite. It kind of wraps things up perfectly. Most of my theater was aghast at what happened, but I thought it was kind of the perfect end cap to the movie. And yeah, just, Todd Solondz, it's just a movie with a bunch of different kind of damaged people and just kind of living their lives and trying to figure everything out like we all are. And I just thought it was equal parts hilarious and then finally in the last section really touching. And I highly, highly recommend it. And Amazon actually picked it up, so it'll come out probably towards, summer, end of the year.
All right. Let's go on to the second tier. Dan Mecca. Second favorite film of the festival.
Yes. My second favorite film is a movie called Love Song, which stars Jenna Malone and Riley Keough as basically childhood into college friends who are meeting up in their 20s after Riley Keough has gotten into a kind of fracturing marriage with a Asian man who is in a cameo role, Cary Fukunaga, actually, which is kind of funny. And basically, Jenna Malone comes to hang with her and her daughter while the husband is away. And you, this kind of love of sorts is revealed between these two women. And what follows is kind of just a modern day star-crossed love, romance. And it's really, really kind of not over route, very well acted. Riley Keough is wonderful in it, and so is Jenna Malone. And yeah, it's really just kind of to the type of movie that totally worked for me, and I found myself totally falling in love with all these amazing female characters. And that's the other thing. I mean, it's like, it's really a movie dominated by women, and it's so refreshing to see conversations by this half of our country that is so rarely given the opportunity in movies to do so. So almost on that alone, I would say really check it out because I don't know if it's been bought yet, but I hope it is and I hope it goes to theaters because I had a really good time with it.
All right. John Fink.
My number two movie is The Fits, which is Anna Rose Homer's meditation on movement, motion, liminality, childhood, racial politics. It's really a beautiful film. I saw it back in December, and I knew that Royalty Hightower was going to be someone that Sundance is going to be buzzing about. And it's about a 11-year-old girl who's living on Cincinnati's West Side. She's in the beginning of the film an aspiring boxer. Her older brother is training her, and then she eventually kind of drifts away and finds her own voice. And the film is told primarily through long shots. It does kind of keep her at a distance sometimes. And then there's a element that comes into play that I think that Flint, Michigan actually wasn't happening or the story wasn't breaking on a national level when I saw The Fits about water that was causing potentially water in the fitness facility that was causing kids to have seizures. in the film. But it's just a really beautiful film. It kind of recalls at times some of Frederick Wiseman's institutional studies, and in that it just watches and observes, and then it kind of takes it to a spiritual and a supernatural level in the third act. But it's a really tremendous movie. It will be coming out this summer. Oscilloscope purchased the film, and I know they're planning on releasing it at the new Metrograph in New York City, so I'm glad that it'll have a chance to be seen. But it's a wonderful film from a first-time a female director, Anna Rose Homer, who's definitely one to watch, and it's a great movie, so keep it on your radar.
All right. Jordan Rapp.
Nice. Yeah, my number two would be Kelly Reichardt's new film, Certain Women, which is another, like Wiener Dog, in structure, it is three separate stories, but unlike Wiener Dog, it does not kind of have that acidic nature to it. It's probably one of the most, after the screening, everyone around me kind of shrugged and said, oh, nothing happened, why did I watch that? Which makes me kind of like it even more. But this is the story of, it's three separate women, Laura Dern, Michelle Williams, and unlike the probably marketing will have you believe, it's not really Kristen Stewart. It's not the the main character in the third story. It's a woman named Lily Gladstone who is really breaks out here. And each story kind of deals with kind of these very small scale events in these women's lives. And it really does an excellent job of just kind of zeroing in on kind of like, you know, a certain emotion. So the first one's kind of betrayal. The second one is guilt. And the second one, and the third one is kind of unrequited love. And they really just do it. Kelly Reichardt, just the way she's able to kind of observe these characters and really just have patience in telling her story and just letting emotions kind of come up naturally. She just does an excellent job at kind of hitting you with these stories that might, you know, that might not seem like they have the biggest moments in these characters' lives, but it really makes you think of, you know, the small moments in your life and how they can have these kind of massive effects and ripple effects down the line. So yeah, it hasn't been picked up yet. I know Sony might have some like other worldwide rights, so maybe Sony Pictures Classics will release it, but definitely stay tuned to the site when, and we'll let you know when it comes out. But it's yeah, if you like Kelly Reichardt, this is you know, Night Moves was more of a, her take on like a genre movie, and this is kind of getting back more to her just kind of very grounded dramas. So yeah, really, really impressed by this one.
All right. Now it is time for the number one films of the festival. So, Dan Mecca, what did you think was the best film that you saw at the Sundance Film Festival?
Yeah, I mean, by quite a margin, in fact, my number one film that I saw at the festival was the new Whit Stillman film called Love and Friendship, starring Kate Beckinsale and Chloe Savini, and based on a novella from Jane Austen that she wrote before she broke out, actually, and then didn't publish, and was ultimately published posthumously almost 100 years after Jane Austen became Jane Austen. And basically, it's about Kate Beckinsale's a star. She plays Lady Susan, who is a widower, but also almost a infamously flirtatious, manipulative woman in London society who cooks up this scheme to get herself remarried to a man of some renown, and also get her daughter married in the same type of scenario that she's cooking up. And it involves lying and betrayal and terrible opinions about people and subverting the social class, and it's all done in a very funny, dry way. It almost feels like when you're watching it, you can't believe that it's taken this long for Whit Stillman to make a Jane Austen adaptation. And I actually got a chance to speak with Whit Stillman after the film for an interview that I think will go up this week. And he was talking about how much he loved this kind of novella, and how in a lot of ways it's almost like a darker version of Emma that it seems like Jane Austen was aware of and didn't publish because it was so forward thinking for the time that it was written. And the biggest thing about this movie, I would say, is that Kate Beckinsale is so crazy good in it. And it's such a reminder that in the midst of all the underworld bullshit, she is like just a rock star. And it's a shame that she doesn't get more chances like this.
So. On top of looking really good in a leather bodysuit.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, John Fink, what was your number one of the festival?
Well, of course, it's Kevin Smith's Yoga Hosers, which I think is phenomenal. No, I'm kidding. Unfortunately,
of course, you really meant
Dan
to say
kind of stole mine, and that would be Abracadabra. Well, Abracadabra is a phenomenal movie. I mean, just look at the buzz it has on Twitter, right? I think Love Song is actually the best film that I saw. So Dan really kind of covered it for Love Song. So there's not really much I can add. It is a really beautiful, really subtle film. I think it's probably So Young Kim's best film. I was a huge fan of Treeless Mountain a couple years ago. But I do want to give a shout out to, well, I think the most polarizing film I saw was White Girl. But I also want to give a shout out to Holy Hell, which we didn't particularly love at the site. But I thought that it was a really powerful exploration of a young man who's searching for kind of a new home and then what those consequences mean. It really gives us privileged access into this cult organization called the Buddha Field. It's directed by the videographer of this organization since 1985, and he's tracking basically this icon and sort of a takedown of this icon. And I thought that it's just really masterfully constructed and really well told. I believe Dan had an issue.
Dan Schindel. I saw it too, actually. It's really compelling. I will say it has one of the best documentary villains I've ever seen. But yeah, for me, the structure of it was just a little too kind of wishy-washy in the second act to really, it kind of loses focus, I think. But the overall message it's kind of unheard of. We've seen so many cult narrative dramas at Sundance in the last few years that it's kind of crazy that you're able to kind of get this footage. 22 years of the footage, and I think they could have done more with that. But I do think that what you're able to see is definitely unprecedented, and it's worth seeking out for sure.
Sure. That would be my endorsement as a kind of tagging on to Love Song, which I really think is phenomenal, and you should seek it out when it surfaces, hopefully somewhere very soon.
All right, Jordan Raup. What was your favorite film of the Sundance Film Festival?
Yeah, so unfortunately it wasn't a big surprise for me, as it was my most anticipated going in, but Kenneth Lonergan did not let me down with Manchester by the Sea. It's only his third movie in 16 years after You Can Count on Me, which was a big Sundance hit, and then Margaret, which had a huge legal struggle with actually getting into theaters, but ended up being fantastic. And yeah, this is another just really incredible feat of storytelling and performance with Casey Affleck. I mean, by now you should really, be on his boat after, Assassination of Jesse James or Gone Baby Gone, or even, the Sundance movie, Ain't Them Body Saints.
And also The Finest Hours.
Oh yeah. The Finest Hours, which everyone saw this weekend.
Big, 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 big hit.
but here, yeah, he is just every scene he just owns. It's fantastic story of him. He's living in Boston at the moment when the film begins, and he gets this call that his brother Kyle Chandler has died. But if you're not Kyle Chandler fans, because the film is kind of this layered, non-linear exploration of kind of grief and how it came to be in his life. And so there is flashbacks with Kyle Chandler, and Michelle Williams shows up for a little bit. I feel like Lonergan is one of the best directors in the sense that he's able to kind of mine these specific moments kind of in between the big moments that either, another editor or producer would say you would have to cut. And he is able to just have these like amazing exchanges, whether it's with Lucas Hedges, who plays, he was in Moonrise Kingdom for a little bit. And he was actually in the Grand Budapest Hotel for a little bit, but he's this up and comer that he plays Kyle Chandler's son. And his mom is estranged. So now he's kind of, Casey Affleck takes him under his guard. And so about half the movie is of their relationship and, how Casey Affleck is dealing with this immense grief, not only from his brother, but from another event that I will not spoil. But it's kind of his kind of entangling just the webs of like his former life where he used to live in Manchester by the Sea, which is the town, which is northeast of Boston that he returns to. And just kind of dealing with all these little minute things that you might not expect from just a story that kind of hits the bullet points, but kind of getting really deep down into what it means to kind of heal and doing so with people that might not want you around. So it's such a fantastic movie, and far and away the best thing I saw at Sundance. And another Amazon pickup, which they bought it for $10 million, which is kind of wild for kind of a relatively small scale drama. So they're going to release it during award season. So I'll be super curious to see how it does, but hopefully it does a lot better than Margaret and has the push behind it that Margaret didn't have. So just fantastic from top to bottom. I was almost going to go see it again if I had the time. So that just tells you how much I loved it. So yeah, it's a fantastic film.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for the top threes. Now for our next segment, we're going to be saying goodbye to one Dan, welcoming on another Dan. So Dan Mecca, why don't you tell the people at home where you could be found after you have left us in the dust here?
Sure. I'm on Twitter at DJMECCA and all over the film stage. And thank you, Brian, for letting me talk about Sundance with you lovely people.
But of course.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So Dan Mecca is gone. But in his place, we have Daniel Schindel. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So we've already talked about the top threes of the gentleman who'd been on the podcast previously. Dan or Daniel, which one do you prefer?
I'm just fine. I go by Dan usually.
All right. You want to give us your top three real quick? Just run it down for us.
Oh, sure. Definitely Kate Plays Christine, The Fitz, and Manchester by the Sea.
All right. So the only one of those we didn't hear about previously from someone else was Kate Plays Christine. So do you want to run us through that one and what you like so much about it?
Oh, I would love to. I can't believe you didn't bring up already. What's wrong with you people?
Look, you have to talk to the other guys.
It was my number four. I loved it too. So,
well, Kate Plays Christine is the latest from Robert Greene, who is carving out a niche for himself in embracing this very deep synthesis between reenactment and like legitimate elements in documentary. So with his previous film Actress, he followed actress Brandy Bure, you know, with her regular career troubles, but also there's a lot that you can tell is constructed, but also doesn't bother to hide it because it just is more concerned with capturing the truth of the situation than with just following along with whatever is going on in her life. So in Kate Plays Christine, he follows Caitlin Scheel, this actress who's, you know, getting bigger and bigger in indie film recently, and who incidentally was also in the first four episodes of The Girlfriend Experience, which played at Sundance and is also magnificent. But they follow Caitlin Scheel as she's studying for his fictional role in a fictional movie based on the life of Christine Chubbuck, this reporter who committed suicide live on air in 1974. And another sidebar, of course, I don't know if you brought this up already, but there's another Christine Chubbuck movie playing at Sundance this year, which is a really super weird coincidence because neither of them, as far as I know, were aware of each other's existence.
Yeah, they were. Yeah,
it's just so weird. 40 years without anything on that story. And then in 1 year, two of them playing at the same time. Lynn Scheel goes through this process of trying to discover stuff about Christine Chubbuck. And again, it's a lot of it is constructed and you might not be entirely sure like what's actually happening and what they're just setting up for the camera. But through the process, the whole idea is that it's setting up this study of like projected identity, internal identity, and perceived identity because, you know, she's playing herself, learning to play someone else. Well, at the same time, they talk to all these people about Chubbuck who, in lieu of any actual evidence, because there's very little physical evidence of like what Chubbuck was like, they fill in their own details about why they think she killed herself live on air. And every time you do it, you can tell that that's just them imposing their own philosophy onto her. And at the same time, Scheel is frustrated by this and sort of becomes more of a void herself as she can't quite get a grasp on Chubbuck. And, you know, it's this great look at performance and trying to internalize someone else and trying to understand our people and like the kind of impossibility of that really as filtered through acting and as filtered through filmmaking.
Interesting.
I will say, Dan, did you see Christine?
I didn't. I really wanted to, but I missed it.
I will say as someone who saw both, I really kind of liked the order I saw them in because I saw Christine first, just the narrative approach. And after seeing Kate Plays Christine, which the ending of it is kind of F you to even the filmmakers of Christine unknowingly. but the process in which you kind of think how just Rebecca Hall, who gives a great performance as Christine Schaubeck in the narrative version, how she kind of went through, you kind of think, you know, how did she go through this process and if it was anything like this. And it's almost like a behind the scenes documentary that for a different film, which is, it's fascinating in its own right. And so, so I would really, a lot of people are kind of pitting these against each other and saying one's better than the other, but I think they kind of enrich each other. And so I hope, neither of them have been picked up, but I hope whoever does pick them up, it might not be a smart marketing strategy to release them, side by side, but I hope, you know, we do get that chance eventually.
Yeah. This was actually one of the stories that I was most interested about. So I'm glad that we were able to bring it up here. Has either of those creative teams commented on the existence of the other?
I thought better than try asking them about when I interviewed them.
I heard some things off the record, but maybe shouldn't be shared. So
boo.
I'll just say they didn't know about it and might not be.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the other films that had come out that caused a splash. So first and foremost, let's talk about The Birth of a Nation.
Sure. Yeah. I think I was the only one that saw that. Correct? Did anyone else see that?
It was a hot ticket to get. You couldn't get in.
You saw it, Dan, right?
I did. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say this. I gave it a B on the site, and you can read my full review. But I do think it has a very powerful message in it, and it really is one of those movies that I would recommend, if only for that. I think it definitely shows. I mean, a little bit of background of the movie. Nate Parker. Tried for 7 years to make this. He's an actor you might have seen, and he was in Anthem, Body, Saints, and Nonstop, and Red Hook Summer, and Red Tails, that George Lucas movie. But he really had to really break out, and this will certainly do it for him. But it's just his kind of, for 7 years he's been struggling to make this movie about Nat Turner's slave rebellion, which is Nat Turner was a figure. Who led the slave rebellion, killing over 60, white slave owners throughout the South. And so it does, the way he films this is very much like kind of a Braveheart-esque tale, where it's very classical in the Hollywood sense of how it's structured and put together. It almost gives a religious, religion runs through the whole thing. And that's one of the most fascinating aspects, I thought, how different verses in the Bible can be interpreted in different ways by the people who have their own agenda for it. And so I think was kind of the most fascinating aspect, but in some sense it does feel, you can definitely feel this is a first time filmmaker, and you can tell he did shoot it in, you know, I think it was, you know, 24 days or less. There's kind of a cheap look to the cinematography, you could say. And it does feel like it's kind of hitting the bullet points in some aspects. But I mean, the finale especially is it's kind of hard not to just kind of get wrapped up in it. And I think it ends I think the very last shot is kind of fantastic in the sense of what it means for progress, potential progress. The story behind this movie is kind of just as fascinating. It's the largest pickup in Sundance history, actually in any film festival ever. In terms of someone acquiring a movie for a certain price, and it was Fox Searchlight who picked it up for $17.5 million. So, which is kind of crazy for, you know, a movie. I think
rumor has it wasn't even their biggest offer.
12 investors put in a total $10 million. So, already
Netflix apparently had offered, as Dan was saying, $20 million.
$17.5 million for a $10 million movie. Which is crazy. So, I mean, I think with the, you know, political race coming up, and I think it can really kind of hit a nerve. But I'll be very curious to see if people kind of beloved the movie or beloved the message of it more. I assume it gets released this fall. For me, I don't think it's a great movie, but I do think it is should be seen based on based on the powerful feel you get when you leave the theater. I don't know if you agree, Dan.
I liked it less than you. I think it's always crazy to me that like these stories that are perfectly suited for adaptation into popular media don't get told or take forever to get told just because they're not about white people. Like also at Sundance, there was a preview event for the new WGN series Underground. Like
it's taken us this long to get anything, like whether it's a TV show or a movie about the Underground Railroad, which is a fascinating subject and one that is like laden with potential for entertainment. It's ridiculous. I'm very glad that this movie exists. I'm glad that Parker was able to get it done. Oh, by the way, you didn't mention Beyond the Lights with Nate Parker, which
yes,
is like,
that is the one. That's his best performance. Sorry. Yes, I love that movie. Yes.
I really liked him in Arbitrage, so I don't know.
But yeah, like you said, it definitely is a debut film, and like that's perfectly fine. Like debut films are allowed to be shaky, and I mean, I mentioned this before, but like the level of hype already built up around the movie is kind of intimidating for a debut film to have. But maybe that'll drop off a bit, you know, in the time between the pickup now and when it ever gets to come out, so people's expectations can settle a bit more for it. The thing that interested me most is that it's much more a biopic of Nat Turner and than it is like actually about his rebellion. And it uses his life as, you know, a lens to look at slavery and that whole time. In that respect, like, I mean, I wasn't expecting that. I was like the rebellion itself is 48 hours, so you can't go full Braveheart on it and like make an prolonged segment about it. But I was so surprised by how
Black Hawk Down would beg to differ.
No, that's true. Yeah, actually, yeah, I can't. Yeah, there is no excuse for not giving me more, you know, blood and
or
stuff.
13 hours.
13 hours.
13 hours.
Point. Yeah, you're right. The brevity of the rebellion really isn't like
Michael
an
Bay
excuse
should
or
make
not.
This movie. That's the
of
real.
Of course. Yeah.
Michael Bay should just make every historic event into a film.
Of course, then there are, of course, budgetary issues. And just, I mean, I assume that Parker was actually more interested in, you know, the whole build-up to rebellion and really taking apart, like, any myths about slavery. Because, you know, despite stuff like 12 Years a Slave, there are a lot of very toxic popular conceptions about slavery, quote-unquote, not being that bad, which this movie, in no uncertain terms, is out to combat. I really love that... like, even the white people who seem sympathetic at first are gradually unlaid to be pretty much either just as bad or, like, I think the most sympathetic one is the mom of the on the plantation who is, like, kindly and teaches Turner how to read, but is also, like, extraordinarily racist still. Like, oh, no, you shouldn't read all these books. They're for white people. Just read the Bible, which, of course... ends up backfiring badly on all the white people in the vicinity.
Yeah, the cathartic feel, I haven't seen in a movie in a while, just when every white person that you came to know kind of gets murdered. It caused an eruption of applause, which is actually kind of strange when people are just going crazy over people getting murdered.
Is this going to be the new Do the Right Thing, where people are worried this is going to start a race war?
Actually, we were talking about that after. If a filmmaker like Spike Lee got his hands on this, I think it could even be more kind of incisive and incendiary. But I don't know. So the screening I was at was a premiere, and it got a standing ovation before the movie even started. So it kind of told you what people were ready for. They were ready for this movie. And then it got two standing ovations or more after, throughout the credits. And then after he came back on stage. So it was no surprise that it won the top two awards at Sundance. But yeah, like Dan said, it's not a great movie, but it will certainly be a discussion point. So yeah, it'll be curious to see how it does.
So on that same level, we were talking about Netflix wanted to pay, what was it, $20 million for the film that ended up going to Fox Searchlight for $17.5. The streaming services kind of came to play this year.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about Manchester by the Sea getting picked up and Wiener Dog as well. Now, the problem with that is if any of these people are looking for awards consideration, it seems like... this year kind of proved that no matter how good the performance of the film, the Academy and everything isn't really going to pay attention to it, as happened with Beasts of No Nation. So do you think that was a major consideration?
Well, in terms of Birth of a Nation specifically, I would say from the THR article, which talks about it, Nate Parker kind of wants everyone to see this movie in the sense that a big push internationally as well as in schools and stuff. And I think Fox Searchlight kind of has their their expertise in that sense with 12 Years a Slave, like being able to kind of get that on a national and global playing field and kind of getting it in the public mindset, whereas Amazon and Netflix are very, very amateur in the sense they have the money, but they don't necessarily have that kind of publicity expertise. Sometimes you might not even know when a movie comes up on Amazon or Netflix, which is kind of unfortunate. And I think that happened with Beast in a sense where they kind of just placed it on there and did a few publicity promotions, but it wasn't anything fantastic. So I think it was a really smart decision to do Fox Searchlight. But it will remain to be seen if it kind of has the success that if the success from the Sundance premiere translates to the world. So we'll see.
Yeah, I was going to piggyback off that too. There were a couple films that did get picked up by those big distributors, and I agree with you. I think that Netflix, from what I was told by someone, they have a smaller kind of inside team that handles that, and I think that's where it just didn't work out for Beast of No Nation. But I forget where I'm going with this now. I'm drawing a blank on what I wanted to say. But I'm kind of curious to see what's going to happen with the Amazon deals, because Love and Friendship was funded by Amazon and then sold to Roadside for theatrical. So they're going to do, I guess, the kind of Chirac style distribution that they had for that, which they went with theatrical and then eventually had a shortened window. So we'll see how it all plays out. I'm kind of curious to see if these films are going to get theatrical distribution. Another one that Jordan and I loved, Morris from America, was picked up by A24 under their DirecTV deal. So that's going to have a hybrid release, but that's a movie that really should be seen with a crowd because it's a crowd pleaser. It's a lovely film. So hopefully these films will find their way. I'm kind of not sure what's going to happen with Wiener Dog. I'm a little cooler on Wiener Dog than Jordan is, but it certainly we're seeing these models kind of come out to play, and there really wasn't too many theatrical deals done this year, which is a little disturbing for lovers of cinema. What are we going to see? Although Hollers, which I know Dan liked, was picked up by Sony Classics. So there's a couple deals. Harvey didn't really buy anything, but I know Classics and Fox bought some stuff for theatrical.
Segue into that, just to talk about one more film, that the one film Harvey did come to with the festival is Sing Street. It was probably one of the most well-received movies at the festival. It's from John Carney, who did Once, and it's kind of has the emotions of Once, kind of on a bigger scope, just in the sense that this is not really a low-budget film. But it's a Dublin-based musical set in 1985 with a bunch of kids forming their own band. And it has it's a really huge crowd pleaser, and that can sometimes have a negative connotation at Sundance. But I think it really does work really well, and it's much better than Begin Again, I thought, his last movie. But I think in terms of the theatrical viability, I think this one could be kind of a pretty big hit. It's the only one that Harvey Weinstein came to Sundance with, and the only one that he didn't pick up anything else yet. So usually he grabs a few. So I know he was trying to get Manchester by the Sea, and I think he could do great with it. But who knows? It's Amazon's game now. So
maybe he'll get theatrical out of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I will say, if just on an end point to this theatrical discussion, a lot of the issue, if Amazon and Netflix, some of the movies they picked up, they only picked up the rights on Netflix or Amazon. So Fundamentals of Caring with Paul Rudd, and there was another one, I forget the name now, but Tallulah with Ellen Page, which we didn't really like. But they only picked up kind of these rights, whereas it's making distributors weary of picking up just the theatrical rights for these movies, because oftentimes they get more revenue when they're sold then later by the distributor themselves to Netflix. So that's why some of these films you might only see come straight to Netflix or Amazon, which is kind of unfortunate side of the game. It'll be interesting.
And then I wanted to ask about a film that honestly seemed like a joke when I heard it. And it's called Swiss Army Man. And this is something that maybe a couple of people have actually heard of. Apparently it involves a dead Daniel Radcliffe.
Yes.
So what's the story here? did anyone actually see it?
I saw Swiss Army Man, yes.
Okay, so what was your impression of it?
My faculty for determining like how much of an actually good movie it is sort of obscured by my just pure love for much of it, which is just 90% guts reaction to copious fart jokes, which I laughed at every single time. But okay, so imagine that classic children's book, The Little Prince, right. But instead of this man explaining how human life works to this little prince, he's explaining it to a dead person who farts a lot. And after a while, I don't know, ambiguously, maybe it's his imagination, maybe sometimes through magical realism, he's actually managing to bring the corpse more to life by explaining more about life to it and helping it understand life more. So it's not just Daniel Radcliffe playing dead the whole time, although I probably would have loved it even more if it had just been that, because that's very funny to me. But no, Daniel Radcliffe does eventually get to talk and show facial expressions and stuff as he's being lugged around by Paul Dano, however you say his name, who has been shipwrecked or just stranded on a desert island, and uses this corpse's various abilities, which include the massive farts, but also include, like, apparently it's a great water filter, or like you can snap his fingers and make fire. And that's why it's called Swiss Army Man, because this corpse is useful for a lot of things and uses it to survive. And a lot, you know, along the same time, explaining stuff about life to the corpse. And, you know, it goes through a very primal, very basic emotional reaction, which is like, yes, life is wondrous and it doesn't make sense. And I don't know, why do we hide our farts from each other? I don't know, little corpse, but it would be better if we did. Yeah, I know. The funny thing is that despite that plot setup, at its heart, this is basically another Sundance movie about a sad young man who is just has so much trouble with his love life and connecting to other people, which is kind of disappointing to me, but, you know.
Okay, did anyone else see Swiss Army Man?
I didn't, but should know it did get picked up by A24, so.
I would agree with Dan. It's interesting, visually interesting the whole time, but yeah, it does kind of lose its steam when it tries to get more emotional towards the end. Kind of gets repetitive, but yeah, it's definitely the weirdest movie outside of The Greasy Strangler that I saw at the festival.
And were there any other strange or interesting movies in particular that we want to talk about before we wrap this up?
And I'll tell you all about White Girl. So this movie is pretty insane. It's been getting comparison. It's been getting compared to. All right, let me start over again. 1, 2, 3, go. So White Girl, I think, is one of the more polarizing films of the festival. It is Elizabeth Wood's semi-autobiographical, if you believe that, story. That tells the story of a young college girl, Leah, who's 19. She's starting her second semester in the fall, and it's kind of a strange trip. Her and her pal move into an apartment in Queens, and she ends up kind of hooking up with a local drug dealer on the corner, Puerto Rican drug dealer, and through kind of some sex, drugs, and electronic dance music, he gets arrested, and she's. It's her quest to bail him out, and it's such a bizarre film, and it really polarized a lot of people. Some people walked out. It's very explicit about sex and drugs and racial issues, but I think the debate that's been kind of touched off is whether or not Elizabeth Wood, has the right to reappropriate Latino culture in the way that she's doing this in this film. And she's had her folks that have defended her on Twitter, and she's had folks like a colleague of mine at the Buffalo International Film Festival who just tore it apart on Twitter and was kind of trying to start a war. So interesting movie, but you know, anytime a movie that can provoke that kind of conversation, I think it's definitely worth checking out to be part of that conversation.
All right. Jordan Raup, any other films that you saw that you wanted to give a shout out to before we wrapped everything up?
Yeah, sure. I liked Ira Sachs's new movie, Little Men, which is kind of about gentrification in Brooklyn, but also a story of just how parents and their decisions can influence kids who are just unbeknownst to what's happening. Really just, if you've seen Love is Strange, his last movie, or his earlier work, you just know how, like, kind of, you know, well-crafted his characters and plot can be, even if they're small scale. And it's another one where he just captures the city in such a great way, and in the problems of the city as well. And just a tender, observant drama. And then Indignation was another one of my big faves, which is James Shamus, after running Focus Features for 2 decades and helping craft the careers of Todd Solondz and Todd Haynes and Ang Lee. He finally made his directorial debut with Indignation, and it's a Philip Roth adaptation. Takes place in early 1950s, follows Logan Lerman as he goes to a Jewish boy who actually goes to a Christian college in Ohio. And it just, you know, if as you might expect from a Philip Roth adaptation, it's just really smartly written. And Logan Lerman gives actually a great performance along with Sarah Gaydon, his love interest, and has one of the best single 15-minute scenes of verbal sparring between Lerman and his dean, played by Tracy Letts. And it's just a really fantastically written kind of coming of age story that has kind of a mature bent to it. So I really like that. And then one other shout out is The Eagle Huntress, which is a documentary actually executive produced by Daisy Ridley, who is really using her Force Awakens powers for very good reasons. I think her Force Awakens follow-up was a Studio Ghibli movie that was 25 years old. Only yesterday she did the voice dub for that, and now she's on to producing this. And it's a documentary about a girl in Mongolia who for the last 2,000 years only men have been able to do their craft of eagle hunting, which is kind of how they survive, is they train eagles for only 7 years and then let them go to the wild. But during those 7 years they train them to hunt for them, and as you might expect with a wide range of camera footage, like drones and GoPros on the eagles even, and different shots, they really paint this kind of beautiful portrait of survival, and but also of kind of femininity and what it can mean in a culture like this. And it's one of those movies where I just wish like every kid would watch this when they're young, and it kind of gives it, it's really empowering to see, you know, what you can do in a culture that doesn't want you to do anything. That was a huge highlight, and that'll probably get picked up soon, I would imagine. It's definitely like a, you know, any audience would enjoy it, I think. So those are my highlights.
All right, well, that is about it for today, so let's sign off. Dan, why don't you kick us off? Why don't you tell us where you can be found online?
You can find me on Twitter at Dan Schindel. That's DanSchindel. And if you Google that name, then everything else will also come up.
So there's no other Daniel Schindels out there that might, like, interfere?
Not really. I mean, I'm at the top of them, not to, you know, brag.
All right. John Fink.
He's a lucky man. I have the opposite problem. excuse me. Cut that out, please, Brian. I am at FinkJohnJ on Twitter, and you can also find me writing over at FilmStage.
And Jordan Raup.
Yeah, you can find me at JP Raup on Twitter and then on the FilmStage. And also, we will be posting a full wrap-up of the festival, and I'll include this in it as well. And you can see our top, I might do 15 this year just because there's so many movies we liked. And, you know, we'll have actually interviews coming up that Dan Schindel did with Morse from America cast and crew, and also Kate Plays Christine, and one with Whit Stillman as well. So Dan's favorite movie, he interviewed the director for that. So lots
and
more
Bob
coverage.
Hawk, the man that discovered Kevin Smith.
Yes, that's true. Yes. So there's more. There's definitely more Sundance coverage, and we'll stay tuned to our Twitter mostly to find out when these movies are going to come be released near you. That's the film stage.
All right. And I can be found on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, and of course I can be found at thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and tune in next time.